I love you.
Love you.
She took it away from me. I can't say nothing about her, see? Morning, y'all. I'm an alumni from Alabama. My name's Bo Templin. Hi, y'all. And I'm glad to be back up here in Mont Eagle. This is one of my favorite places to come. Shirley and I used to come up here a while back, and then our lives changed, and we couldn't come up here for a while. So it sure is neat to get to be back up here. And I want to tell you why it's one of my favorite places to come. The reason is that I've learned over the past 21 and a half years that you don't become a spiritual person by reading spiritual books. And you don't really become a spiritual person by rubbing up against other spiritual people. You become a spiritual person by doing spiritual things. And when I come up here, I get to be in a very spiritual place, because this is to me. And I get to observe some of my favorite spiritual people doing spiritual things, so that I can get an idea of what I need to do if I'm going to be like y'all when I grow up. So that's one of the reasons that I love coming up here so much, is that I get to be around the spiritual people and watch spiritual things being done. So thanks, guys and gals, for inviting us back up here. There's another thing I want to do, and I probably got about 3 hours of stuff I need to talk about, but I'm not. Don't worry about it. But I'm going to get as much in as I can. But it's just, you know how things get flung on you every once in a while? You know, and you just got to do them? You ever been there? When something it was just flung on you and you had to do it. And this just got flung on me last night. After we did the sobriety countdown last night, and I found out that there was somebody in this room with 35 years sobriety, and then there was somebody in here with six or seven days of sobriety. So what I want to do this morning, I'm not going to do an Al-Anon countdown, but I want to recognize somebody that's real, real important to me. She has been a big part of my recovery ever since I got here, Labor Day weekend, 1982. She founded what was to become my home group. In June of 1961, she was the founder of the Bessemer Al-Anon Family Group. June of 1961. Now, she's still an active member of Al-Anon today. So I got my calculator out last night, and I figured that up, and I figure if she keeps coming to these meetings and acting right till June of this year, she'll have 43 years in Al-Anon. Now, that's real important, and that's one of the reasons that I wanted to recognize her this morning. The other reason that I want to recognize her is that as I share my story with you today, you will hear me several times refer to the old-timers or the old way of doing things. Well, you see, she represents the old way of doing things because she comes from the old school. Now, I know that because she's my grand sponsor. That means that she sponsored my sponsor. So she taught my sponsor what my sponsor taught me. And it has been so, so important to me the last 21 and a half years. So if you would, take just a second and let's recognize Mickey right here on this front row. Thank you, babe. Thank you. There you go. One more thank you, and then we're going to talk some Al-Anon. Okay. I want to thank the guys and gals that are sitting in this room this morning that are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to talk just directly to you for just a minute. And I want to say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous this morning from the very bottom of this Al-Anon's heart. And I want to say thank you for basically two reasons. Number one, I want to thank you for being there 21 and a half years ago when Shirley reached out her hand. Because you see, the bottle had her, and I couldn't do anything about that. And I was driving myself crazy trying to find a way to get her sober and keep her sober. And of course, I never could find that. And when she had that moment of clarity that I believe all recovering people have, and when she had her moment of clarity and reached out her hand to AA, you had the hand of AA there for her. And let me tell you, folks, it was some of y'all that was sitting in this room right here this morning that was part of that deal that had your hand there for her. And you put your arms out and you took her in and you put your arms around her and you loved her back to health. And Shirley didn't have to die from a fatal disease that we didn't even know she had. Because you see, what I know about alcoholism today is I know beyond a shadow of a doubt it's a disease, and I also know that it's a fatal disease. And I know that my gal was dying, and we didn't even know what the deal was. And you didn't put any conditions on it. You just put your arms around her, and you loved her back to health. And because of that, and because of me being introduced to something called Al-Anon and two kids being introduced to something called Alateen, we put that family back together. And we put it back together in rooms like this full of folks just like y'all. And then, as Shirley told you last night, last Friday, we celebrated 40 years of marriage. And it's all because of people like y'all in rooms just like this. So I thank you for saving my gal's life. I want to thank you for another reason. I want to thank you for knowing from the very beginning that this thing called alcoholism is a family disease. Now, you see, I know that you knew it from the beginning because being raised by old-timers and being sponsored by old-timers, I've been raised in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been sponsored in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. And being taught from the old school and the old way, I have been taught the history of our fellowships. And so, understanding the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that the very first meetings were family meetings. The whole family went together. And you included the family. And I also know from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that you knew it was a family disease because the 8th and 9th chapters to the wives and the family afterward are written directly to us as family members. And you included us from the very beginning. So then in 1951, when it was time for Al-Anon to be born, and we said, can we have your 12 steps? You throwed your arms open and you said, well, sure you can. And here's what we want you to do. We want you to come in here, take this 12-step program, learn how to implement these spiritual principles in your life on a daily basis, and learn how to be happy, joyous, and free, and it not be dependent on what another person does or does not do. And for that, I'll be eternally grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I introduced myself to you a minute ago, I introduced myself as an Al-Anon. Let me talk about that for just a minute. Because when I got here Labor Day weekend in 1982, I thought being married to Shirley made me an Al-Anon. And what I've learned is that being married to her qualifies me for Al-Anon. It does not make me an Al-Anon. And there's several things that I do today on a real regular basis in order to tell you that I'm a member of Al-Anon. And I want to share two or three of those things with you. The first thing that I share with you today that I do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon is I suit up, I show up, I occupy that chair in an Al-Anon meeting on a real, regular basis. Now, I know that this is a program of action. I know you can't get it by osmosis because I tried. The first 7 months that I was around this thing, I was trying to rub up against y'all and get y'all's recovery to rub off on me, but it didn't work. And it took 7 months of me suiting up and showing up and occupying a chair. It took 7 months for me to learn just how sick I was. And it took 7 months for me to learn that I was going to have to participate in my own recovery. But it started with suiting up and showing up and occupying that chair. Now, let me explain it to you this way. I can take that chair, take it out to the back of the lot, and I can sit it in the middle of the chicken coop, and I can occupy that chair in the middle of that chicken coop every day for 20 years. And guess what? I still won't be a chicken. But if I do that every day for 20 years, at the end of that time, I'm going to know a whole lot about chickens. Now, you understand what I'm saying? It's suiting up and showing up and occupying that chair in that Al-Anon meeting for those, with those old timers and those winners that was there for me. And watching them, as I've already shared with you before, that I began to get an idea of what I was going to have to do in my recovery program. So it starts with suiting up, showing up, and occupying that chair on a real regular basis. Now, the next thing I share with you that I do in order to be a member of Al-Anon, and remember, I'm just sharing with you what has worked for Bo over the years, is that I have to have a home group. Now, my home group is the Wednesday night discussion group right there in Bessemer, Alabama. When I got here in 1982, I didn't need a home group. You see, when I got here, I didn't need Al-Anon. There was nothing wrong with me. She had the problem, and if she didn't drink, we were going to be okay. And I was convinced of that, and I told you that with a big grin on my face. But at that treatment center that Shirley went to up there, they did have something called Family Week. And that's where me and two teenage kids went up there on Monday and moved in and lived up there until Friday. Lived in the facility. Now, they call it Family Week. I call it Hell Week because that's what it was. But I heard some things up there in Hell Week that made an impression on me. And the first thing I heard up there that really made an impression on me was I heard one of them counselors say, the people that stay sober when they get out of here are the people that go to AA. Well, in the snap of a finger, my job in life changed. Because, see, I'd already told you, if she didn't drink, we was going to be okay. Well, now this counselor just told me if she went to AA, she wouldn't drink. So I became the driver. That was my job, was to make sure that she was at those AA meetings. Well, the next thing I heard up there that sounded pretty good, it was, they said that it's a good idea if you go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And we did. Yeah. Now, if you're an Al-Anon, you understand that. But I wasn't going for me. See, I was going, like I told you, to make sure she was. We was sitting down there on that front row, and we was listening to them speakers, and that speaker say something important, and I'd pop her with that elbow. I was listening real close. Because, see, she is still in a fog, and I knew she was going to have some questions, and I was going to have to be able to answer them. Yeah. And so we're going to these 90 meetings in 90 days, and we're going to the Bessemer a lot, which was to become our home group, and we're going to Hewittown, which had just started up, and we're going all around our area, and we're making those 90 meetings in 90 days. And I learned something about you AAs during that period. I learned you AAs has got real serious tunnel vision about two or three items. And one of the things you've got real serious tunnel vision about is something called closed meetings. Real serious. Because the night came and we showed up at Bessemer, which was to become our home group, and we walked in and them guys met me at the door and said, Bo, this is a closed meeting tonight and it's for AAs only and you won't be able to stay in this meeting. And I said, well, you don't understand. And they kind of laughed like you did. And I said, it's my job. And they said, no, it's time that you left her in here with us. And it's time for you to go to a meeting over there in that room. And they not so gently nudged me toward the door of the Al-Anon room. Now, I was still in the ism of my disease at that time. By the ism, ISM of my disease, I mean I sponsored myself. The first 7 months that I was here, I sponsored myself, and I had a fool for a sponsor. Now, once I got a sponsor, an old-time sponsor, I was taught that you show up for every meeting that you go to at least 30 minutes early, prepared to stay till it's over. See, I was sponsored that a lot of Al-Anon meetings are over in an hour, but some are not. And so my job is to be there at least 30 minutes early, prepared to stay until the work is done, ever how long that takes. Okay. But I didn't have that sponsor then. See, I was still sponsoring myself. So it was 2 minutes to eight when I got over there to that door that night, and the meeting started at eight. And I looked in there, and I took a quick head count, and there was 23 women and one other guy. And there's an empty chair down there by Curvin. Remember Curvin? And so I hustled down there, and I got that seat by Kirvin, and we had the meeting that night, and then the meeting was over, and Kirvin turned around and introduced himself to me, and I said, "Man, I'm glad there's at least one other guy here." And he said, "Oh, Bo," he said, "I'm moving to Panama City, Florida in the morning." He said, "This is my last meeting here," and he said, "I sure am glad to meet you before I leave town." And see, that was just God taking care of me, because God knew how sick I was. And it's taken all 23 of them women for me. So he just got Kirvin out of town. Because if Kirvin had been there and had a problem, I don't know what we'd have done. Because I've kept all 23 of them women real busy. But see, right after Kirvin introduced himself, you know, and told me he was moving, well, then these gals started coming up to me because they knew he was moving. And they start welcoming me and trying to hug me, and I didn't want to hug them. And they're smiling, and they're saying, "Boy, Kirvin's leaving, and you're coming in. We're just so glad you're here, and welcome." And I said, "Whoa, hold on just a minute. Let's make sure that we understand here. I won't be coming in here on a real regular basis. I don't need this. My wife has the problem, and if she don't drink, we're going to be all right. And so I'll only be coming in here the nights that they won't let me stay out there." And those gals, you know what they did? They just continued to smile and continued to tell me to keep coming back. And you see, it was a long time before I realized how important that was. And it hadn't been too many years ago, and there's some people in this room that's been in some of these meetings that I'm fixing to talk about. It hadn't been too many years ago that I've been set in some Al-Anon meetings where people tried to judge who belonged and who didn't. Remember when the court started sending us all the people, and a lot of the people were coming from treatment centers, and they would come to the Al-Anon meeting, and they'd sit in there and they'd say, "Well, my husband or my son or my daughter, whoever is in treatment, and they're a cocaine addict." And the people in the Al-Anon room would immediately try to start judging whether they were supposed to be there or not. And thank God they didn't judge me in 1982 in Bessemer, Alabama, because I told them I didn't belong, you see. They didn't have to make a judgment. I went in there and told them. And they said, "That's okay, you just keep on coming back anyhow." See, the answer to the deal finally came down from Lois before she died, our co-founder. At one of the World Service deals up there, they took the delegates took that problem to Lois, and Lois chastised them quite severely. She said, "What are y'all doing here talking to me about judging whether somebody belongs or not?" Said, "Your job is to give them an Al-Anon meeting when they show up, and then let them make the decision of whether they belong or not. Set yourself free of this and just love them. When they come in the door, put your arms around them and love them and give them an Al-Anon meeting and tell them what Al-Anon is and is not. And then they will make the decision." Well, that's what those gals at Bessemer did, you see. They just put their arms around me and they loved me. And they began to very gently put their hooks in me and pull me into this thing. And they didn't even tell me about it. And see, what they did was they hooked me and pulled me into this thing and kept me here until my miracle happened. Yeah. Let me tell you about two or three of those hooks right quick. The first hook they used on me was a hook called laughter. Man, how important is laughter to you? Well, let me tell you how important it is to me. I think it's one of the most powerful healing tools that we have for the newcomer, is laughter. Think about when you first got here. How important was the laughter to you? I'm going to tell you how important it was to me, boy, because I hadn't had any laughter in my life in a while. And as I think back, I realize that very first meeting that I went to that night, you see, was full of laughter, because it was a speaker meeting. And one of our old-timers was sharing her story. And I'll call her name because there's two or three people in this room, Doris C. Remember Doris C? Doris C went down there to the front of that room and got behind that podium, and she said, "Hi, my name's Doris, and it's been 14 years since I had to plan a murder." Yeah. And the whole room erupted in laughter. Everybody except me. I didn't laugh. And in my mind, I'm sitting there, I'm saying, no, I'll never admit that out loud. You'll never hear me say that. Because, see, I was just like some of y'all that are shaking your head. I was going to kill her and tell God she died. Yeah. But see, I realized before the meeting was over, Doris's story was full of laughter and full of fun, and I realized that nobody was laughing at her. Everybody was laughing with her, because she was laughing harder than anybody. Thoroughly enjoyed it. The next hook that those gals used on me is one I've already talked about a little bit, a thing called hugs. Now, let me tell you about my group down there, my home group. We hug you when you get there, and we hug you when you go home. And in the middle of a meeting, if it's apparent that you're in pain and that a hug might help, somebody might get up and walk across the room and give you a hug right in the middle of a meeting. See, we believe in the healing power of hugs. Yeah. But when I got there, I wasn't real huggable. I didn't want your hugs. See. And so here's what those gals did for me down there, and they still won't admit it today, but they did. They took a chair. Now, this part of it I know is true. They took a chair and they set it right inside the door of the Al-Anon room. And they designated that as Bo's chair. And they said, Bo, we know that you don't want to come in here, and we know that you're not going to come in here unless you just have to. So on the nights that you come in here, this is your chair. This is far in this room as you have to come. And on the nights you're here, nobody else will be allowed to sit in this chair. We'll keep it open for you. Well, nights I'd go in there, I'd sit there and I'd occupy that chair. Well, here's what them gals did, and they still won't admit it today. They assigned a woman to me. And it changed on a monthly basis because my home group believes in rotation. And here's what that woman's job was. The way we close our meetings at my home group is we stand and we hold hands and we say the Lord's Prayer. Now, being sponsored by old-timers, I've been taught that the Lord's Prayer ends with the word amen. Consequently, in my home group, we don't say anything after the word amen. So we would stand up to close the meeting, we'd hold hands, and we'd say the Lord's Prayer. See, I'd have to move down to get in the circle. And we'd say the Lord's Prayer, and we'd say amen. I'd let go and start for the door. And there she'd be. Yeah, between me and the door. And see, her job that month was, while we had our eyes closed, to slip out of the circle and get between me and the door. Because her job was to give me that going home hug. Yeah. And of course, as she gave me that going home hug, she whispered them words. You know, you keep coming back, Bo, because we need you. Well, you know, if you needed me. And I was going to be bringing her anyhow. What I didn't tell you was that I had begun to read some of your literature and some of this stuff had begun to make sense to me, and I had begun to make identity. And what I'm talking about, you see, is the things they did that just kept me coming back till my miracle could happen. Now, let me tell you about the last hook that I'm going to share with you, and then we'll move on. And it's a hook that they began to use on me that very first night, and they still use on me today. And it's a hook called unconditional love. That very first night there, they began to shower me with unconditional love, and I had no idea what it was. They didn't identify it. They didn't name it. They just did it. And then I began to sit in meetings, and I began to hear about unconditional love, and I began to hear you sharing about unconditional love, and I began to become aware of what unconditional love was. And then after a few years down the road, it became very, very evident to me that I had become an absolute professional at receiving unconditional love. Become the best that there is at sopping it up. And I began to get concerned then about, Bo, are you doing the best job you can do at giving unconditional love? No doubt about how good you are at receiving it. How good are you at giving it away? Well, when I get a dilemma like that, me and my committee up here, you know, you've got that committee too, we meet and we decide what we're going to do about it. And I said, well, so me and the committee decided that I needed to learn everything that I could about unconditional love. So I began to go off and I began to get up around the old timers and rub up against them and ask them questions and about unconditional love. And I began to get opinions from here to here. And I began trying to find books to read on unconditional love and opinions from here to here. And I got more and more confused. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, I'm sitting in San Diego, California, at one of these deals. and it's Friday night, and there's an AA speaker up there, and he's making his talk, and he gave me the answer about unconditional love. Now, he didn't know it. He wasn't even talking about unconditional love in his word. He was talking about his relationship with God. And I began to listen to him as he shared about his relationship with God and what an intimate, close relationship he had with God and how much he used God in his life and allowed God to use him. And he began to share about this vertical relationship. He talked about it as the vertical and the horizontal. And he talked about when I'm okay in the vertical with God, then I'm okay with you. And he said, and what I try to do today is I try to work real hard on maintaining my vertical relationship and staying spiritually fit. Because he said, you see, when I'm spiritually fit, God uses me as a channel of his love, and God loves you through me. He said, now what I want to challenge you people here tonight is work on your relationship with God and become spiritually fit so that God can use you as a channel of his love and God can love me through you. And I said, wow, dummy. He's talking about unconditional love. The one that is the master, the one that is perfect in unconditional love is the God of my understanding. So instead of working on what unconditional love is or is not, all I got to do is work on my relationship with God so that God can use me as a channel of his love and that God can love you through me. And if it's God's love, it will be unconditional. And so that's the deal about unconditional love today. I work on being the best child of God that I can be and being spiritually fit so that God can love you through me. And I challenge each one of you to join me on that spiritual journey. It's a fun, fun way to live. It really is. So those are the hooks that those gals begin to use on me to keep me there for that seven-month period until my light bulb went on and my miracle happened and I could make Bessemer my home group. The next thing that happened that I do that in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon is I have sponsors. Yeah. I've already told you, I've got a grand sponsor, so I got to have sponsors. And my sponsors come out of the old school. They believe in doing things the old way. When I finally got sick enough and I looked for a sponsor there in Bessemer, most people in this room know who I asked to be my sponsor, and that was Fran D. And there were no other guys curving and done gone to Florida on me. And so I asked Fran, and Fran, you know, she agreed to be my sponsor that night, but she put a condition on it. And I said, what's the condition? And she said, well, Bo, I'll sponsor you the way I've been sponsored. And that's the only way I know to do it. And I said, well, what's it? And she said, in the steps. And if you're ready tonight to make a commitment to me to implement these spiritual principles in your life, then I'm ready to take you by the hand and walk with you. That's a pretty stout commitment, but let me tell you, she stood true to it. Now, about 90 days into this thing, I needed to talk to a man about some things, so she sent me out there in the AA room, and she said, you pick you one out there that's working a good 12-step program. Well, I happened to pick the one that she had been married to for 100 years. And she and Jim became my sponsors and my mentors and my guides. And you see, once again, that was God taking care of me, and I would have told you God didn't know where I lived. But God gave me the best of AA and the best of Al-Anon. Because he knew just how sick I was. The last thing that I'd share with you that I do today is that I take those 12 simple steps that we read up here. 12 simple steps for a very complicated person. And to the best of my ability, I incorporate them in my life on a daily basis. Getting up each morning and having that little talk with God and asking God to come into my life and to direct my life today. And once I got in the process of living my life that way, it sure has simplified Bo's life. Because you see, when I get up in the morning and I say, God, I'm awake, and I'm asking you to come on in here and take over my life and manage and run my life today, then I just took me out of the equation. So think about how that simplifies it. All I got to do then is go out there and put one foot in front of the other and be the best Bo I can be, doing God's will. Yeah, doing God's will. Chuck Chamberlain, an old guru from the West Coast, said it this way, and I don't know of a way to improve on it. He said, my business each day is to do God's business. God's business each day is to take care of me while I'm out there doing his business. Yeah. And so these are the things that I do today in order to tell you that I'm a member of Al-Anon. Now, let me tell you right quick a little bit about me and about how I got here. In order to do that, I go back and start with this statement. I was born at a very early age. And it's necessary that I go back and start there, you see, because I was born down there in Bessemer, Alabama, right in the middle of something called a Bible Belt. Now, you folks up here in Tennessee, you know what I'm talking about. I was born right in the middle of something called a Southern Baptist Bible Belt. And I was born into a very strict, very religious Southern Baptist home. Now, I don't know how spiritual we was, but let me tell you, we was religious. And Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night, we was in that Southern Baptist church there in Hueytown, Alabama. And this went on until up into my late teens when I left home. What's important about that period in my life is that it was in that Southern Baptist church in Hueytown that I formed a concept of God that I brought into adulthood that caused me some problems. Now, it wasn't the church's fault, because you see, I remember the church teaching me that God is love and God is forgiving. But for some reason, the concept that I brought into adulthood is that God's going to get you. And I had a very judging and a very punishing God. And that was my concept of God when I came in the doors of Al-Anon years later. Being raised in this religious home, I wasn't around any drinking, so I didn't know anything about drinking. And I met Shirley in our mid-teens, and we started dating, and she didn't drink. Now, for different reasons, she come from that broken alcoholic home. But the deal is, I didn't drink, and she didn't drink, and we dated for five years, and we didn't drink. And then we made the decision to get married. And we got married, and we set out on this thing called a Great American Dream, which means we started chasing the dollar. We thought we knew about life, and we didn't know anything. What we knew about life, or what we thought we knew about life, was that successful people were the ones who worked real hard, made lots of money, and had the most nice stuff. And the more nice stuff you had, the more successful you were deemed to be. So we wanted to be at the top of that list. And we both had good jobs, and we set out to do that. Made that down payment and got that first place out there in Hueytown. And then 3.5 years along came that Mike, you know, that bundle of joy, that beautiful blonde-headed, blue-eyed baby boy, you know, that's what every daddy wants. He wants that boy. And we had him. And then 17 months later, along comes Sissy, just as healthy and just as beautiful, and she's brown-eyed. And we sat down and took stock. We had 2 kids, and we had 2 cars, and we had a house, and we had 2 jobs, and everything we had was mortgaged to the hilt. And we was happy chasing that dollar. And Shirley joined that sorority, and we went to that sorority party down on the Warrior River. And I did something that was going to cause me some grief for several years. I handed my wife the first drink of alcohol she ever had. And my wife is talked about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it says with some females, the disease just takes off and is rampant, just rages. And that's the way it was with Shirley. It didn't take long for her to be full blown. And she was right up in my face, and she was shaking her finger, and she was saying things like, Bo, if you'd never given me that drink, I wouldn't be the way I am today. Well, you see, we didn't know anything about alcoholism, and so I agreed with her. And I took on a load of guilt that was to grow heavier and heavier and heavier until I found the doors of Al-Anon. And it was a load of guilt that was almost to get to be to the point that it was unbearable. It was almost that bad when I found y'all. Now, I could stand up here the rest of the morning and share war stories about our trip through active alcoholism. And I love war stories. But I'm coming to believe that war stories are best told, you know, around in the hospitality room, around with a cup of coffee. And I see some funny looks here. There may be some folks in here who don't understand what I mean when I say war stories. Here's what I mean when I'm talking about a war story. A war story starts at the in the hospitality room. We're sitting around talking, and I began to tell you about cutting my little finger. And I cut it right there where the little finger, now it wasn't a bad cut, but it just wouldn't stop bleeding. And every time it would just about stop bleeding, I'd forget and bend my little finger and it'd start bleeding again. It was just real pesky. Well, old Floyd's sitting there at the table with us. And he just shakes his head and he said, "Bo, you talking about a scratch?" He said, "Man," he said, "2 years ago, he said, Vera had finally talked me into doing something around the house there. And he said, I was trying to make a little old repair around the house there. And he said, and I cut my little finger real bad. He said, it took 37 stitches. Said, when I got through stitching it up, you couldn't even see my little finger." And Milton's sitting there. He said, "Well, y'all don't know nothing." He said, "About 5 years ago, he said, I had somebody there trying to buy a car, and he said, I couldn't get it to crank, and I was out there trying to crank it, and he said, and I was working on it, and he said, and I cut my little finger off, and it grew back." See, that's what I'm talking about by war stories. If you've ever been in a newcomers meeting or something, you know, I tell one, you got to tell one just a little bit better. See? But I've learned something about war stories over the past few years. And what I've learned is that my war stories and your war stories are the same. All the times are different and the places are different and the fingers are different. But you know what's the same? The pain. That's what war stories are about. The pain is the same. So I'd like to share with you two or three of the pains that I experienced on our trip through active alcoholism. And the first pain I share with you is a pain called anger. Now, I don't know about you, but let me tell you about me. On a good day, I got up angry and went to bed angry. And on a bad day, I got up angry and I went to bed in a blind, running rage. And toward the end of it, I probably couldn't have told you what I was mad about or anything. I just knew I was mad. The next pain I'd share with you is a pain called resentment. And I didn't know what resentment was until I got to Al-Anon and y'all taught me. But as I look back, I realize I was living my life full of resentment. Because see, the time had now come in our life that if you lived up the street from me and I saw you and your family out in the yard together, cutting the grass or washing the car or cooking out, doing something together, then I resented you. Because alcoholism had taken that away from us. We didn't do things together anymore. If I saw you and your family get in your car and come by our house going somewhere together, I resented you. Because you see, we didn't go places together anymore. And of course, when you came by my house, if your car was nicer than mine, I resented you. Because your alcoholism had taken the nice things and they were going and we didn't have them anymore. But the biggest resentment of all, the biggest resentment by far, was this resentment at God. Because you see, God was continuing to punish me for giving Shirley the first drink and setting this thing in motion, and he was punishing me through her drinking. And this was my relationship with God at that time. This was how I communicated with God at that time. "All right, by God, God, how much more of this are you going to put on me? What kind of God are you, God? I know I gave her the first drink, but by God, God, it can't be that bad. How much more of this do you think I can handle it? And how much more of this are you going to just heap on me?" And that was my relationship with God when I found the doors of Al-Anon. Now, the next pain I share with you is one that I hear alcoholics talk about all the time. It's a pain called loneliness and isolation. And I know that yours is the disease of loneliness. I just want you to know that you ain't got a corner on that market. I know about loneliness too, and it ain't got a thing to do with how many people are in the room. Some of the loneliest times of my life have been in crowded rooms surrounded by people. And these people would be laughing and cutting up and having a good time. And I'd be sitting there with that old fixed smile we had. You know, the one that hurts your teeth? Ha, ha, ha. And I'm looking at y'all and I'm saying, how can you be so happy? How can you be having so... If you had a drunk wife at home like me that you couldn't sober up, you wouldn't be that happy. And I'd want to say to you, can you tell me something else to try? Because you see, I've tried everything I know to try. But before I could ask you, the red flag would go up. No, you don't let them know. You don't say anything to them about what's at home. Because see, if I let you know that I had a drunk wife at home that I couldn't sober up, then I had to deal with that other pain that was really eating my lunch. And that's a pain called failure. See, I'm the Southern dad. I'm the head of the family. And I'm supposed to be able to fix anything that comes along. And I couldn't fix my drunk wife. So I sat there in a crowded room and I stuffed it. And I didn't talk about it. And I didn't let you in on it. And that's lonely. That's lonely. And that's the way I was living my life in July 1982. Full of guilt, full of fear, full of shame, full of embarrassment, full of resentment, anger, with a fixed grin on my face, walking around telling you I was fine. Because you see, we were four individuals living four separate lives under one roof out there in Hewittown. But we had that great unwritten rule out there that every alcoholic family has. And that rule is you don't talk about it. And what you did at our place right before you went out that front door, you stopped and straightened up and made sure everything was in place, including that old smile. And you lived the lie. You lived the lie. Well, it's July 1982, and the kids and I are going to another softball game, and one more time we hadn't asked Shirley, and she didn't want to go anyhow, because we'd be gone for 4 or 5 hours, and she'd be free to drink and do whatever she needed to do without us being there. And Mike stopped at the door that night and looked at his mom and said, "Mom, when we get home tonight, you're going to be passed out on the couch or passed out in bed. Where are you going to be passed out?" And as Shirley has already shared with you, she raised her hand to slap his teeth out. And when she did, you know, that moment of clarity. We never know when that moment of clarity is going to happen. And the scene flashed through her mind of the last time that her drunken dad beat her with the belt buckle of that belt buckle end of the belt. And she cried out and said, "Dad, if God ever allows me to have kids, I'll never lay a hand on them." Yet here she was with a hand raised to slap her son's teeth out, and she had a drink in this hand. And she couldn't deny it any longer. Well, Mike didn't wait for the answer. God took care of that situation. Mike just came on, got in the car, and the slap didn't have to happen. And when we got home from the game that night, I knew something was different when I pulled in the driveway because the front door was open. And I saw Shirley walking around inside, and I knew she wasn't passed out. And it was well past her passing out time. So when I got in the house, she met me at the door and she told me that she had called a treatment center and that she was going into treatment to do something about her drinking. And I reacted today just like I know I was supposed to, with all the sarcasm I could muster. And I said, "This is number 1,382. And I told her I didn't believe her. And I took a shower and went to bed. And it was the next day when the treatment center called me for insurance information that I even believed her. But you see, God was directing our lives then. Because God sent us to a treatment center that believes wholeheartedly in treating it as a family disease and believes wholeheartedly in the 12-step programs of AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. And we didn't know the difference. And God sent us where we needed to be for just a short period of time, where we could come out and turn the corner into your arms, where we've been ever since. Now, let me tell you a couple of other things that happened up there at Hell Week, because it's important. I had not been on the property up there. Me and two kids, Mike, 15, Sissy, and 13. We went up there on Monday morning to check in, and we had not been on the property 5 minutes till I was in my first little discussion. They sent us down to this wing where we would be living for the week, and there was 18 people up there for family week, me and Mike and Sissy, and 15 other people representing other patients. So as 15 people up there, I didn't know. And there, we're down there on that wing, and this woman is in charge of it. She says, "Mike, I want you down at this end of the hall in the room with Mr. So-and-so. And Sissy, I want you up at this end of the hall in the room with Miss So-and-so." I said, "Hold on just a minute. Now, you're putting my teenage children in a room to live for a week, for 5 days, with people that I've never met before and that I know nothing about. I'm not so sure that I approve of this." And she looked at me with that big grin and she said, "Oh, Mr. Templin, it's not necessary that you approve of it." She said, "You've got 5 minutes to be in this room unpacked and upstairs in the group room." Yeah. So you know where I was 5 minutes later? I was unpacked upstairs. And then my miracle really, the starting of my miracle began. Because this guy came in that afternoon and he did a deal for us up there for all us family members. And what he told me was, he said, "Bo, alcoholism is a disease and your wife has that disease." And he said, "And if you follow our directions and you go to Al-Anon when you get out of here, and that's what we're going to direct you to do, and if you follow our directions, then in Al-Anon you're going to be taught about the three C's. The three C's being that you didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you can't cure it." Well, you see, I needed to hear that. I knew that I couldn't control it and couldn't cure it. What I needed to hear was I didn't cause it. Because you know what I took up there with me? I took that load of guilt. Yeah. And it was right there that afternoon when he told me that she had a disease, and since it is a disease, I'm not responsible for it. It was there that I started the process of shedding that load of guilt. Now, I finished that process in Al-Anon. But I started it right there because that's the first time I heard about it that afternoon. Let me tell you what else they taught me in Al-Anon. That since it is a disease and I'm not responsible for her having it, then it is no longer necessary for me to try to be responsible for her recovery. And that allowed me to detach from her disease and to turn my wife and her disease over to the God of her understanding. And to put her in God's hands where she belongs. And you know what that did for me? It freed up a whole lot of time and energy for me to spend on me. Yeah. The next thing happened up there that week is they had a lady come up there and hold an Al-Anon meeting for us. And she is from the old school. She's an old timer. And by that I mean when she came in there, she didn't sugarcoat it and she didn't water it down. She came in there and held that meeting for us that night, and God sent her especially for me because I got vivid memories of that meeting, and there was 18 of us people in there, and I remember her pointing her finger and saying, "Bo." She talked directly to me. That's my memory of that. And what she said that night was, she said, "Bo," she said, "I'm not here to water this thing down." And she said, "I'm here to give you good, orderly direction." You see, that's what God knew that I needed that night. He sent me an old timer that brought me good, orderly direction. She didn't give me any options. No, I didn't need options in my life at that time. I needed good, orderly direction. And she said things like this. She said, "Bo, if you want to regain your sanity and begin to experience any serenity, then you're going to go to Al-Anon." End of sentence. She didn't come in there and say, "I hope you do," or "I'm here to encourage you to." She didn't even use the infamous, "Why don't you try 6 meetings? Nah, she just looked and said, "Big boy, if you want what we've got, then Al-Anon is where you will go, because that's where you get it." And right before the meeting was over, she threw in the kicker, said, "And by the way, if you're going to be any kind of daddy at all, you're going to make sure those two precious children are introduced to Alateen." Where was the oldest, strongest Alateen group in the state of Alabama at that time? Right there in Bessemer, Alabama, alive and well and functioning, just waiting on our two kids. Well, me and the kids dodged bullets the rest of the week, got out of Hell Week. We didn't run, knock the doors down. We waited till Shirley got it out. We waited on her. Picked her up at 12 noon on Saturday of Labor Day weekend with instructions to go straight to the Bessemer group. We couldn't go by the house. We had to go straight to the Bessemer group. And there we were going to meet up with a group of people, and we were going to form something called a convoy. And we were going to convoy down to Tuscaloosa, Alabama for the Tuscaloosa AA Al-Anon anniversary. Now, I used to love convoying the meetings. I know some of y'all in here that are real experienced at convoying. We don't do it anymore, do we? I guess we're too busy or something. I used to love getting in a convoy going to a meeting. Let me tell you about that convoy that Saturday of Labor Day weekend. And all I can tell you is that the story grows as it goes. I'm up now where there was 85 vehicles in that convoy. And we had everything. Well, we had 2 doors, 4 doors. We had Suburbans, station wagons, pickup trucks. We had taxi cab. We had motorcycles. We had everything that you could imagine in that convoy. Now, every one of them was a drunk vehicle. By that, I mean it wasn't a straight piece of sheet metal nowhere. And it didn't one of them have an air conditioner that'd work. And here we are. We got enough folks for 125 vehicles, but we ain't got but 85. And so we're crammed in and arms and legs out, you know, and off to Tuscaloosa just having a blast. And we walk in down there on the campus of the University of Alabama to that AA Al-Anon anniversary, and we walked into your arms. 500 of y'all was at that thing. Yeah. And we fell in love with you immediately. Because you see, you was dressed up, you was cleaned up, you was dressed up, you had on fufu juice, you was running around there laughing and hugging and having the time of your life. And we didn't know all about you, we just knew whatever you had was infinitely better than what we brought to the table. You know that thing about attraction rather than promotion? We fell in love with you right then. As Shirley told you, they had a male Al-Anon speaker that night. Unheard of in 82. Male Al-Anon speaker. I missed him. Oh, I was there. Sat in the room. Missed him. Go see, there was nothing wrong with me. I didn't need anything that he was talking about. When Marty got up there and introduced herself, I tuned in. Because you see, I knew that she was sober and that she was going to tell me how to keep Shirley sober. So I can still just about today, I told Marty not too long ago, we saw her and spent some time with her. I said, I can still quote your story 21 years later. Well, we left that place and we come home and me and Shirley and 2 kids stayed up all night long talking about y'all. And we made a commitment as a family that we was going to give this thing our best shot. And that commitment so far has led us to being right here this weekend. Now, what a ride that's been. What a ride. We asked the kids to go to those 4 Alateen meetings, and then we'd talk with them. And as Shirley told you, Mike went, and he said, it ain't for me. But that's okay. That's all right. You know, my son did not claim to be a member of Alateen because he didn't go to the meetings, and he didn't do the things you're supposed to do. But he lived a life based on spiritual principles. Now, the only thing I can tell you about that is that he got those spiritual principles right there in that home that he was living in, because we were living our lives and our family and our home based on spiritual principles. Sissy fell in love with it, just couldn't drag her away. And like I say, she's 35 today with 21 and a half years of Alateen and Al-Anon. Shirley's over there and she's got a sponsor and she's got a big book and she's serious about her sobriety and she's involved in a recovery program and she's growing spiritually and getting well. And I'm sitting around over in the Al-Anon rooms, floundering around, taking up space in your room, telling you there ain't nothing wrong with me and I'm getting worse. And after 7 months of that, I came home one night and I looked at her and I said, you're so happy. What are you doing? And she shared with me about her sponsor and about her book and about her program and about her new relationship with God. And she told me, she said, same thing is available to you in Al-Anon. If you want it, go get it. And it was the next night that I went back to Bessemer and made Bessemer my home group and asked Fran to be my sponsor and started the spiritual journey that I'm on today. Now, it wasn't too far down the road in this thing that I decided I needed to do that inventory. So I started writing it. I didn't ask Jim and Fran about it. You know, I knew enough about this now. I was going to write that inventory, and I guess I was going to surprise them. And here's the way I did as a newcomer. Fran would back me up on this. I didn't call them till I ran it in the ditch. Now, do you sponsor anybody today that does it that way? Most of them. And when I ran it in the ditch, then I'd pick up the phone and call. And I said, well, I got it in the ditch again. And Fran would, you know, or Jim would say, well, come by the house this afternoon after you get off work. We'll have a cup of coffee and we'll talk about it. So I called one day and I said, well, I've run it in the ditch again. And they said, well, come on by. So I went by the house and the coffee was made and we sat down there at the kitchen table. And I said, look, I'm trying to write an inventory and I just can't get it on paper. It's just not working. I'm having all kind of trouble. And Fran looked at me immediately and she said, well, certainly you're having trouble. I said, Fran, where do you get this wisdom? 30 seconds ago, you knew nothing about this. And she said, well, son, if you're trying to do the fourth step, you're in a whole lot of trouble because you ain't through with the third step. And until you do something about your concept of God, you're not going to go a whole lot further in this thing. And that's when Jim, my AA mentor, reached out at his kitchen table and took me by the hand. Said, come with me. And we walked into his study, and he sat down at his desk, and he pulled out the textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous. And with me and him sitting right there in his study, he took me into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he took me into the chapter to the agnostic. And it was right there that afternoon that I found the God that I have in my life today. And I found it right there in the pages of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a God of infinite power and of infinite love. Can you imagine? Infinite, never-ending, never-ending power, never-ending love. And you see, I know today that God is so busy loving me and forgiving me that he doesn't have time to judge me and punish me if he wants to. And let me assure you that I keep him real busy loving me and forgiving me. So I've got this new concept of God, you know, and I said, well, I got it now. I'm off and running. Spiritual growth is fixing to come. Watch out, mountain. Here we come. And I was running just hard as I could, running away from God. Go see, in that Baptist church where I come from, when you turn it over to God, you had to become a song director or a Sunday school director or maybe even a missionary. And I didn't want anything to do with that. And I'm running from God. And God worked with me then just like he works with me today. He allows me to get just as miserable as I want to get. And when I finally get as miserable as I want to get, all I have to do is turn and he's closer than my next breath, ready to take the pain away. But he'll allow me. He loves me so much that he'll allow me to get just as miserable as I want to get. So I'm getting more and more miserable. And I get up one Wednesday morning and I look at Shirley and I said, you know, I don't want to go to work. And she said, well, stay home. And I said, I don't want to stay home. And she said, well, what is it? And I said, I want to get away from me. I'm miserable in my own skin. And I don't know what to do about it. And I finally decided I'd go to work. I could be miserable there and get paid. And I set out to try to get to work that morning. And at 8:05, Mickey, you'll know exactly where this is. At 8:05, I pulled my truck out of traffic right across the street from the pipe shop in Bessemer, Alabama, on 19th Street. And 8:05 that Wednesday morning, I sat there and I beat on the steering wheel and I hollered at God. And what I hollered was my version of the third step prayer. Because what I said was, God, I don't know what I got that you can use. If that's Fran, you tell her that I have got a coat and tie on. Okay? All right? Because she checks on me. And I said, God, I don't know what I've got that you can use. And God, I don't know where we're going to have to go, and I don't know what we're going to have to do. But whatever it is that I've got and wherever we got to go and whatever we got to do, God, let's do it. Because I said, God, I can't fight you anymore. And I surrendered. And as I look back, I realize that what I did at 8:05 that Wednesday morning is I fired Bo as the general manager of Bo's life. And I looked around and I hired the best general manager that was available, and that's God. And my biggest job in my life from 8:05 that morning to right here with you this morning, my biggest job has been to keep Bo fired and God hired. And as long as I can keep Bo fired and God hired, this thing stays right between the ditches, right where it's supposed to be. You see, it's when I fire God and I take over control that my life gets unmanageable again. So now that I've got this new relationship with God, then the spiritual growth really began to come. And our family began to come back together. And recovery became more and more evident. And then, of course, two or three tragedies happened in our life. And I want to share a couple of those tragedies, not for the tragedy itself. I'm not trying to do an impact thing here. I want to share it with you because I want to be able then to share with you the part that you played when it happened. That's the good news. That's what's important about it. And of course, the first tragedy of enormous magnitude was on May 17, 1988, when Mike was killed by the drunk driver. And we looked at those three policemen around midnight that night, and of course, the wind was knocked out of our sails. And we were immediately right back to square one. But I remember going to the phone and calling Fran, and I told Fran, I woke her up, I told her what had happened. And I remember Fran saying to me, "Bo, you got to hang the phone up." And I said, "Fran, I don't want to hang this phone up." Because see, I was connected. I had her on the other end. I said, "I don't want to hang this phone up." She said, "Well, you got to." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because we can't come to you while I'm talking to you on the phone." You see, that's what this way of life is about. You see, 12 steps in a book is just 12 steps on a page. 12 steps on a wall at our clubs is just 12 steps on a wall. 12 steps in action is something to behold. And let me share something with you people. We generate a power when we gather together that my simple mind is not capable of comprehending. There's a spiritual power that's here with us this weekend that absolutely is beyond my wildest imagination. And Shirley and Sissy and I have been privileged to experience the depth of that strength and the depth of that power. You see, within 45 minutes of us getting the news of Mike's death, AA and Al-Anon was in our home. And you came in the door and you said, "Hold on a minute, we're not here with answers. We don't understand this any more than you. We're here because we got big hearts and we got open arms and we got soft shoulders. And we want to put our arms around you and love you through this if you will allow us to." And that's what you've been doing. That's what you've been doing since that night. You put your arms around us and you've been loving us through this. Share with you real quickly about the last time I saw Mike alive, because you played a part in that. Mike was killed about 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night. The last time I saw him alive was 7 o'clock that Tuesday morning as he was leaving home to go to work. He still lived at home. And he came by my chair where I had my cup of coffee, and he tapped me on the shoulder, and 20 years and 6 months old, just as full of life, loved life, tapped me on the shoulder and said, "I'm going to work, Dad." And he started for the door. And he got about 3 steps across the room, and he stopped and turned around, and he looked me dead in the eye. He said, "I love you, Dad." Out the door he went. And you see, I'm here today to thank you for being able to say that the last words I heard my son speak was, "I love you, Dad." And the part you played in it was you taught us how to live that way. See, we wasn't living that way when we got here. And you taught us how to live that way. You need to know that that morning wasn't out of the ordinary. We did that most mornings. Everything between me and that boy was done. All the amends had been made. It was a done deal. Me and my boy was okay. And it's all because of rooms like this, full of folks like you. Well, we had to start that walk through the deepest, darkest valley that a daddy will ever have to walk through. And I'm convinced today, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that I have walked through the deepest, darkest valley that I will ever have to walk through. Oh, if something happened to Sissy, it would be just as deep and just as dark, but it wouldn't be any deeper, and it wouldn't be any darker. So I've already made the walk through the deepest, darkest valley that I will ever have to walk through. The good news that I'm here to share with you today is that I never took one step of that journey alone. And I'm not here to share with you folks something that I believe. I'm not here to share with you something that I've read or heard. I'm here to share with you my experience. I know this from my own experience. You see, I never had to take one step of that journey alone. God had this hand. AA and Al-Anon had this hand. And we made that walk. So I'm convinced today that there is nothing, absolutely nothing out there that this world can throw at me that I can't walk through as long as God's got this hand and you've got this hand. It's powerful. That's powerful. And I came here 21 and a half years ago to learn how to keep her sober. Ain't God good? Ain't God good? Life begins to come back together as we walk through that. Sissy falls in love. Bob comes riding into her life. They make the decision. They get married. We sell that place out there in Hueytown. We become land barons. We went out there to West Blockton and bought 2 acres. Cleared it off. Moved out there. Me and Shirley on top of the hill. Bob and Sissy down at the bottom of the hill. And we got 2 beagle puppies. We live far enough out in the woods that there's no lease law. And we got 2 beagle puppies, and we're looking for an Allopup group. Okay. And we know which one needs to go to Al-Anon, and we know which one needs to go to AA. We know. Yeah. And life is coming back together again, and things are getting okay. And then we find out that Sissy's got that aneurysm. And Shirley became okay with that pretty quick. Sissy became okay with that pretty quick. I was a basket case. And let me tell you why I was a basket case. And I didn't realize this while it was going on, but it became evident pretty quick to me. The reason I was a basket case was that when I found out my daughter had an aneurysm, you know what? You know what aneurysms do? They burst and they kill you. That's what aneurysms do. And when I heard that my daughter had an aneurysm, I had her in that casket. I don't know if you do that or not. When something bad happens, I go to the worst. And I had her in that casket. And I couldn't walk up to her just like I could to Mike because of this reason. There was an amend that I had been trying to make to my daughter that I couldn't find a way to make. And there was one thing left undone. And I'm telling God, God, you can't have her because it ain't a done deal. Got just as selfish and self-centered as I could get one more time. All about Bo. Yeah. Because you see, I had been trying to find a way to make an amend to my daughter for not taking her to church as a child. My daughter never had a God of her own understanding until she got to Alateen when she was 13 years old. And I felt responsible for that, and I felt guilty about that, and I couldn't find a way to make that right. And now here she is with an aneurysm. Well, you know the deal. We should have known it was a God deal from the beginning, but we missed that. See, because you ain't supposed to find aneurysms, and we did. God directed us right to it. Well, we found the only brain surgeon in the state of Alabama that didn't think he was God. Sissy found a brain surgeon there in Birmingham, and she took me up there to his office and showed me the plaque on the wall. And here's what the plaque said. It said, this medical practice believes in spiritual healing, and if you don't adhere to these principles, we suggest you find another medical practice. And the last thing that doctor did that morning that he operated on our daughter was he and his medical team surrounded the operating table and held hands, and he prayed. That's the last thing Sissy remembered before they put her to sleep. The next thing she remembered, she woke up in ICU. Well, you know the deal. God was in charge. It was textbook surgery. Yeah. The doctor said the only mistake he made was he didn't video it because he's a teaching surgeon. And he said, I need it. This was so textbook I could have used it in the classroom. And I didn't video it. Yeah. Operated on her on Tuesday morning, came into her room on Saturday morning and said, get out of my hospital. Go home. I can do nothing else for you. All you need to do is heal. He said, and by the way, on your way out, would y'all stop by the waiting room and tell those folks they can go home? And he said, housekeeping has said that they cannot have one more pizza party in the waiting room. Because see, that was y'all. That was as close as you could get. And they were bringing pizzas in 12 at a time. And pizza parties down there, because that's as close as you can get. Yeah. That doctor said, he said, I don't understand it, but I like it. He said, I like it. Yeah. So, of course, Sissy was grounded. So about 2 weeks after she's home, I get home from work one day. There's a note taped to our door for me and a note for Shirley. And I take my note, I go in there and I sit down in my chair and open it up. And here's what my note from my daughter says. It says, Dad, I want to thank you for the God that you have in your life. And Dad, I want to thank you for believing so strongly in your God that you share him openly with me. And Dad, I want to thank you for being able to pray for me during this time. And the craziness went away. Because you see, I knew right then that the amend had been made. We just had to go through brain surgery for me to figure it out. Yeah. Ain't God good? Ain't God good? So we began in the process of getting it back together and hanging close to you and seeing the one thing that we keep learning over and over again through this is that when something bad happens, we no longer run away. When something bad happens, if we are away from you, we run it to you as quickly as we can. Most times we're right in the middle of you anyhow. Yeah. And then a couple of years ago, because of an old back injury, I finally had to, it got so bad they couldn't do anything else. And they said, well, we're just going to have to do surgery on you. And my doctor looked at me and he said, what surgeon would you like to go to? And I said, well, I know of one up there in Birmingham that did a real good job on my daughter. And so I was able to go back up there and let that man do the fusion and all on my back. And I had to retire. And I didn't want that. And I fought that. And I got very, very selfish one more time, you see. Selfish and all about me. I ain't through yet. I need to make a little more money so that our retirement can come together. I don't know. And God said, oh, no, you're going to retire. You're going to retire. And I really finally found out I didn't have any choice in it because I couldn't work. And so I retired. And what's been revealed to me since then is that God has a whole lot of stuff for me to do out there. And he's kept me so busy the last 2 years doing his work that I wouldn't have had time to work at a full-time job. And God knew that there wasn't any way that I was ever going to do this work unless he took control. So he did. And so for the past 2 years, I've been full-time in the business of doing God's work. And that's been absolutely more fun than I know how to tell you about. Because once a month I get that check in the mail. The other thing is, and I was asked if I would be sure and share with this with you and tell you just how good my life is today. I got two things in my life that work today: my watch and my wife. And so I get up every morning and have coffee with Shirley, and then I see her off to work. She's got the best job she's ever had in her life, absolutely loves her job. She does such a great job that they just did an evaluation on her and called her in and gave her an 8.5% raise. That's unheard of today, isn't it? 8.5% raise, that's what kind of employee she is. You know where she learned how to be that kind of employee? From y'all. We didn't know that. We didn't know that. Everything that we have today, we've learned from y'all. So life is back good today, and we're going along, and God's keeping us busy, and our job is just to put one foot in front of the other and be out there and be available and do God's work. But you see, I must have you in my life to do that. I must have you. And let me explain that to you why. See, I've never seen the burning bush. And I've never experienced the cool breeze or the flash of light. But the God of my understanding speaks to me on a real, real regular basis today. And when God speaks to me today, darn if it doesn't look and sound a whole lot like you. You see, you're my channel. You're my channel. And that's how important you are to me in my recovery and in my relationship with God. So now that you understand, there's two things I hope you understand today as I close this thing. Number one is just how big and just how powerful my God is. And number two, the important part that you play in that relationship. So here's the deal as I close. I'm going to keep coming back. Rooms like this full of folks just like you. Now you're part of the job, deals, I want you to keep coming back. Rooms like this full of folks just like us. Now if I keep coming back and you keep coming back, then one day, somewhere down the road, our paths will cross again as we trudge this road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.